I'm Autumn Brown.
And I'm Adrienne Marie Brown. I'm so happy that you came home. I didn't think you're coming back. I'm Adrienne Marie Brown.
Oh, and this is How to Survive the End of the World,
our podcast about learning from apocalypse with grace, rigor, and curiosity.
And that's the whole show.
And that's it. We made it. And we're back. And we're back. Okay. Should we start with talking about you being away a long time, or should we start with which season?
I mean,
Or a general check-in.
Let's start with a general check-in, and then that can guide us into, like, what feels most. I did prepare, I think, some really juicy questions for you.
Sister, I always have juicy questions for you. I live in that zone.
I know.
I mean, some only us, for you.
Some of us have to think about it before, you know.
It's hard. It's hard out there being a basic question asker.
Being a basic bitch
is difficult. Okay. Wow. Listen, sister, first of all, I'll go first and I'll just say I missed you.
Oh, I missed you too.
I missed you so much. And like, I missed you even though we were in touch every day.
The entire time.
I still missed you. Because I missed this dynamic of getting to be in a conversation with you. There's so much to discuss in the world. Sure. And I'm really grateful that you're back. I am feeling a little allergy overload. Mm-hmm. And it's my fault. I forgot to take my allergy medicine for 2 days in a row. And it's like a cumulative thing. So
yes, it is.
And then it's beautiful outside. So it's been like we're in the zone where I'm like, I want to go, you know, wake up and step out onto my porch and be like, hello, squirrel, and hello, little bluebird. Hello, black cat. Hello, everybody. I mean, like, it really is getting to be like a creature haven. My backyard is giving so much life to me right now.
Your backyard is like secret garden.
It really is secret garden. Like, I feel like I put in the energy, really the investment. I put in the investment to have people put in the energy to put in a nice backyard. I was like, I don't know how to make it nice, but if someone makes it nice, I will go be there.
Yes.
And I now have started to take care of it because I'm like, oh, you're not part of this garden. You are. Like, I could feel it.
Ooh,
like weeds, you know, there's certain weeds where I'm like, you don't belong here. Right. You're fine. There's nothing wrong, you know, right?
Nothing wrong with you.
You're not bad. Right. You just don't go there up on the mint. So, but I'm like, but you are mint. The best part is like the elementary school pride of being like, that's mint.
Yes.
And I know it for sure with my nose and my hands and like my eyes, you know, I'm like, that's mint. That's lavender. That's rosemary. That's sage. That's oregano, whatever. So I feel very pleased with that. And then my period just started and I'm in the stage of perimenopause where my period only comes when I need to have my lovers over. It's just like, wait, is someone coming over for intimate time? Here I come. And I was like, baby, no, but I thought we were skipping this month because you didn't show up anywhere close to when you were supposed to.
Right.
No? You were waiting for this moment. This is your moment too. Okay, great. So, but it's
your period. Your period is like, oh, are we about to release?
Yes. It's release time.
I was just waiting for
someone to open the door. I was just waiting here. Well, and you know what's so funny is it's even, I hope this isn't TMI for our listeners, but if it is, too bad.
you signed up for this podcast, whoever you are.
You're here listening. They're like, well, I came for the politics. But anyway, the thing that I find really interesting is my period knows the distinction between lovers, like familiar and new. It also knows that. So it's like, if it's a familiar, then it's just like, oh, no. That doesn't spark joy for me. That doesn't make me, I'm not going to just come for that person because they
right.
You know, like, but I'm like, this is the new person spelunking for the first time in this cave. Hi, I am the goddess of this cave. I thought you'd never come. Yeah.
I am the goddess of this cave.
I am the goddess of this cave.
Actually, Adrienne. That's such a beautiful reframe of what a period is.
Oh, yes. The goddess of the cave.
The goddess of the cave.
It's helping me a lot to not be bitter about it, because I'm like, I know we just met, but the goddess of the cave is someone that likes to meet on the first date.
It's so sacred, actually. It really is such a – it's a sacred time. It's a sacred time. Yeah. And I feel like – I don't know. There is something, especially with a new lover, there is something that is so like profound and vulnerable about making love while you're on your period.
Oh, hell yeah.
Like, it's so
intimate. Test too. Not like a bad, you know, like, are you down? But there's like a test that's like, do you know how to worship the goddess of the cave? Because she, yeah, otherwise it's not going to work for us for very long.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, because, you know, so far this is a part of my life. So, and not sleeping together for a week each month has never been a part of my life. And I strongly discourage that for all humans. So, anyway. Ow. So I think that's my check-in. Well, there's a lot more, but I think can come out in the conversation. It's been a big year.
Yeah. Yes, it has.
It's been a big year.
Yes, it has. I'm thinking about, where we were a year ago.
Yeah.
What you were going through.
Yeah.
I mean, it's wild, actually.
It really is wild. Yeah, well, maybe I'll just say that part now is like...
Go for it.
We just celebrated... Not celebrated. What is it? We passed.
One year,
right? We passed over 1 year of my friend dying. And his birthday is a week before his death day. So it's just this week now that it was just like, oh, this portal. And, you know, I think I've been learning so much about the, like, we just have rituals for so many things and we do not have nearly enough of a culture of ritual around friend death. What it means to live in a world where, you know, it's like, if you lose someone who's like, this is my life partner in some way, this is my sibling, this is my parent, people are like, oh, I understand how to orient to the grief you have there.
And the anniversaries
like matter, right?
Right.
And like you hold them with each other, you know, it's like, oh, I know one of my dear friends, her mom's death anniversary is coming up. And I'm like, I know when it is every year. Mm-hmm. I know how, you know, that we spend a lot of time around Mother's Day. You know, it's just like you're present with it. Yeah. And I have noticed that it's so different for friend loss, right? Where you're like, there's an expectation of like, well, move on. And you don't make such a big deal that you weren't their partner, you know? And it's just like, no, I was something else and other and more and less than that, you know? Like there's just these other relationships. So there's something really beautiful about being in community with a lot of people who are all missing the same person. Yeah. And there are just lots of little miracles that happened, in that regard, but I keep feeling like there's kind of a Russian doll aspect to life right now where there's like the tiny me and I'm like, I have my tiny tragedies. And then there's the next level up of like, oh, my local community and like what's happening here. And then my country, oh, she's a mess. And then, you know, region, world. My energy, the spirit of the world. And on every single level, I just feel like so much discontent and so much like grief and so much just swirling shadowy energy that we're in this time. Yeah. And I still feel like I have a good life. So I'm really trying to figure out like what's happening? Because I feel so much every day that I'm like, these are overwhelmingly hard things to feel. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling them. And I still feel very like, my good life, I mean, I'm connected to my purpose. I'm connected to people and community. I have love. I have pleasure. I have stability. You know, and then I've been producing. So the other big thing that happened this week is I turned in the manuscript for Ancestors, which is the final book of the Grievous Trilogy. And I didn't know how that would feel, but it's been massive. So right. Big.
Of course.
It's so big. It's the biggest thing I've ever worked on for the longest amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, it was such an act of faith and grief and love. And I thought I was done with it a couple weeks ago. Like I was like, turned something in and I was like, it's not quite there, you know, but all the parts are, everything's in place, but it's not beautiful. Right. Like to me, like when I read through it, mm-hmm, I'm like, okay, mm-hmm, you know, that's a pretty line. That's a pretty way of speaking about this person, that you, the story arc is beautiful. You know, like I really want it to feel like,
oh, you want the line level writing to feel poetic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, yeah, I want to do my best. Like, with making some beautiful words and honoring these characters. So that's how I'm doing over here, sister.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm so excited to be like returning to you, yeah, and returning to the show.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is so wild timing, the timing of things, because we were, as you know, we were set to record our reunion episode like a month ago or,
yeah,
I don't know, like there were a couple of moments where we tried, where we
scheduled, like, we'll do it now. Yeah.
And then we had to reschedule. And so now here we are recording our reunion episode and I go back to my job in less than a week. And so it's just interesting to be in this, I mean, this whole last year has been like a year of portals, of like entering portals, moving through portals, closing portals. And then like, you know, it happens again, it happens again. And so it's just, I'm like, oh, I'm in a new portal. The new portal of like my sabbatical is really truly coming to an end. And how I'm feeling right now today is that I'm actually finally arriving in a sense of like acceptance of the fact that my sabbatical is ending. I spent a lot of the last 3 months really feeling grief, mm-hmm, around the fact that my sabbatical was going to come to an, right, end. And of course, you know, no surprise. I'm sure that's not surprising to, yeah, anybody, but it's like, it's been such a sacred, incredible experience. It's been such a beautiful, like, unfurling of my creativity. And I mean, it's also been incredibly hard in so many ways that, of course, you know, I couldn't have predicted and didn't, no, expect, but on the whole, it has given me a view into a way of being that I feel very committed to. And so there's fear in me. Yeah. There has been fear in me in the last few months that's arisen in relationship to like, oh, what if I quote unquote go back to work and then I'm not able to continue living into these commitments?
Yeah.
And I think the shift that's happening right now, just in the last few days, is this feeling of like, these are mine.
These are yours. That's right.
They're mine. This is my life. This is my way of being that I have now created for myself, and I can create that way of being in relationship to my work.
Yeah. Or anything you do.
Or literally anything that I do.
Literally anything. Yeah.
So that's like the broad strokes. I think in this moment today, I'm feeling hopeful. I've been going through some, you know, the last month in particular has had contours of a lot of intensity on multiple sides, yeah, of my life. And felt like, you know, I think the month of April astrologically for everyone was just like, it was a shit show. And it was like a cluster of fucks. And so, it was a cluster of fucks. I felt a sense of like, kind of stressors encroaching on all sides and not feeling, yeah, resourced enough to be able to meet them and maintain a sense of like, I can meet these stressors while rooted in my values and my purpose and rooted in like best practices. And so I found myself in the last month really falling into some older patterns for how to meet stressors.
Yes.
And what's good is like, it was good. It was actually really, useful to kind of like see where the old patterns still want to emerge. And then to be like, oh, hi. Oh, look at you. Still right there, ready to help me cope. Still right there, ready to help me escape. Still right there, trying to
let's get out of here.
Trying to protect me. Exactly. Like so many of the old patterns are patterns that are like, danger, 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 you know? And so it was like helpful to be like,
it's just hard when danger is everywhere.
Right. Exactly. It's like, you know, I mean, we've talked about this for so many years on this show. You and I talk about it all the time in our healing work is like, how do you train your nervous system to actually be able to differentiate between real danger and memory?
Yes.
Or things that trigger memories of dangerous circumstances. And the last month has been a lot of me having to do the work of like of replacing myself in the present moment.
That's right.
And I have to say, I had this really incredible, again, like one of those alignments where you just can't make this shit up. So I, as you know, but listeners wouldn't know, I have navigated two pretty serious injuries in Aikido in the last year. So over the course of my sabbatical, at a time where I expected to be practicing Aikido more than ever, I actually ended up spending a pretty significant amount of time off the mat because I injured my knee in July and was off the mat for 2 months, made a full recovery, and then
come through body.
Hey! And then, but then I injured my ankle at the end of February and was off the mat for, you know, like 6 weeks or so. And I'm back in training, but it's going to be a while before I'm able to resume like the level of training that I'm accustomed to.
That's right.
But I was visiting a different dojo. I was visiting a dojo in Philadelphia when I was injured, and the teacher, the head instructor of that dojo, we've just developed this like very wonderful connection in the weeks since. Because he's continued like checking up on me and just expressing a lot of care. And he sent me Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart, in the mail. But I didn't start reading it right away. And I didn't pick it up to start reading it until it was probably like a week ago. And and it was wild. Well, this is what I'm getting to. It was wild because the first line of the book is her describing that she started writing this book while she was on sabbatical.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, of course, this is the last book that I'm picking up to read in the final stretch of my sabbatical.
Exactly.
And it's like exactly the medicine that I'm needing right now. And it's just helping me really like pull out of, you know, there's just a way for as humans, like our design is that when we're in suffering, there's a way that we can just get so in the tunnel of the suffering, like drilled in, sucked into our own story of our suffering. And reading this book is helping me just like really see the wider picture around my life and around any particular subjective experience of suffering. There's a wider experience around it. And I can tune into that. I can't always, but I'm trying to.
You're like, but more than before.
More than before. Yeah, it's like I'm noticing how I don't, you know, like one of the big changes, the sabbatical. And I'll talk about more about this when we get to the part of our conversation where we're talking about sabbatical. But you know, when you're taking this kind of a break, it's like you get to really think about a larger chunk of your life, you know. And when I think about where I was like 7-8 years ago, narrating the details of my suffering was very important.
I remember.
When I'm not orienting to my suffering in a healthy way, that is still what happens.
Yeah.
But what I've learned over that time period is that like, oh, the details of my suffering and my need to narrate them, is like an expression of how attached I am to being someone who suffers.
Yes.
And all of my stories of victimization and the ways that that gives me meaning and purpose and la, 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 la. And as you know, in my freedom work, that a huge part of the freedom work that I've been doing as both a political practice and a spiritual practice is really about releasing attachment to suffering as the thing that gives our lives meaning.
Yes.
And so it's been helpful. It's been really helpful here at the end of my sabbatical to be like, haha, there it is again. There it is again. Look at that. And it's like, no judgment, no judgment, self. Like that's, we are all, you know, we're all made of the same stuff.
Yeah. Well, and it is really beautiful to see patterns like that when you're like, oh, like this wisdom comes from somewhere. It comes from living through it and making a different choice and being like, oh, a different choice is possible. A different choice is available. And I have found I really like to then harness when I do catch myself in that narration now, I like to harness it for content. I'm just like, that'll be a great monologue. That's going to, she's going through it. That girl gone through it.
What happened to her?
Yeah. You know, or like, or just, check. I don't know. I think I told you I was egged yesterday. Yeah. I sent you. I was egged. My car was egged yesterday.
That
right?
is so wild to me.
It is really wild. And what's really wild to me is that I have a video of the guys who did it then egging another car. But because I'm an abolitionist, I'm not sending it to the police. But I pulled over and I was just like,
for myself, I needed to document
just
this.
For me. Well, you know what it is? For me, I wanted to document it in case there was damage to the car so that I could be like, you know, insurance, whatever.
Right.
Like,
right.
You, these are the people. This is what you can see what happened. They're throwing eggs. Right. But also, I was just like, I thought it might help deter. It did make them leave. When they looked up and saw that I was filming them, then they got off the roof.
Right.
So I was like, just stop doing this. This is actually a really mean thing to do, to throw eggs through people's. They were aiming for my sunroof. And
which is literally dangerous. It's dangerous to throw something into someone's car while they're driving.
It's incredibly dangerous. Right. And it's mean. I mean, like physically, it's I'm like, you could really hurt someone from that height.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, you guys are 4 or 5 stories up throwing something. But anyway, the narrative piece of it, right? It's like, oh, how would I have responded to this 15 years ago, 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. How would I have responded to it last year? How do I respond to it now? Right. And I'm like, what is my story about the people who did it? What is my story about myself?
Mm-hmm. Right? And why it happened to you?
Why did this happen to me? Mm-hmm. And you know me. I've been in like, I'm like, I keep experiencing like, oh, is Mercury retrograde maybe just never stops for me? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. You know, lately it's been very like, if it can be janky. So I'm just starting to be like, it's going to be a little janky. Like, everything's a little off. Everything's a little dramatic.
Everything's a little raggedy.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Everything's a little like, you know, I was like, oh, the air filter thing fell out the ceiling. Like, you know, like there's just stuff where you're like, what?
Right.
A, I didn't know that could happen. B, why are things falling on top of me?
Right.
But then in the context of all the shit that's going on in the world right now, I just have this sense of humor because I'm like, well, you know,
I have
like,
a house.
I have everything I need right now. It's just janky. And you know what Americans deserve right now? Jankiness.
Yes.
Like, please. I think that I'm just like, I don't mind if that's what happens. You know, these systems are falling apart already. Mm-hmm. Bridges are falling down. Everything's falling apart. And there's a real sense for me of like, this is my personal part of that chaos. Right.
Right. Right.
And get used to chaos because we're heading into chaotic times. And mm-hmm. and we're in chaotic times and that's just going to keep increasing. And like whatever spirituality we have, whatever organizational systems we have, they have to be the ones that help us move through chaos.
That's right.
Because chaos is what we live in and what is increasing. And that has been so liberating for me. Instead of being like, where is the order? Find the order. You know, I remember a chiropractor years ago being like, you need a firm bed. Right? Because with a soft bed, your back is always looking for where's the ground? Where's the ground? Where's the solidity?
Uh-huh.
And so for some people, it can really cause serious back pain and back injury.
Right.
If you don't just go ahead and get a firm bed and be like, this is the way through the chaos of sleep time.
Right.
is my back will know, my body will know that's the bottom. Right. That's it.
Right.
Rest.
Right.
Right. And I feel like that I'm looking for touch points like that now where I'm like, okay, it's a free for all. Everything is buck wild. There's front lines everywhere. Mm-hmm. My sense of humor is becoming my firm mattress.
There you go. There you go.
Right. Where I'm just sort of like, you know what this is? Funny. Mm-hmm. Like no matter what else is happening right now, humans are hilarious. Like we're so ridiculous.
Yeah. And oh yeah, we are.
Combative for no reason. It's just silly. Mm-hmm. Like I really imagine aliens and gods looking at us just like, I don't know. I mean, they're entertaining, right? Like mm-hmm. I feel like from looking at the planet level, you know, like I'm like, I hope someone is watching this, like Real Housewives of Earth, you know, like these people are messy. And then she's going to do that. She's such a mess. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So humor is my firm mattress.
Humor is my firm
all right,
mattress.
So
that's a t-shirt.
This is the other thing I'm realizing is I need to have like an invention factory where I just put t-shirts and ideas into something where I don't have to do them. And it's just a copyleft idea box. And then someone makes it.
Exactly. Like,
can someone make this?
Can someone make that?
I'm not going to make it. Someone make it. It's a good idea. All right. Sister, I think we should go to sabbatical.
Yeah. Okay.
I think so. I think I want it.
It's right there. It's available.
It's right there. It's right there. It's right there. And which I have the right to say.
We are allowed. We're allowed to. We're from the South.
That's one of the accents we can do, just so everybody knows.
I was born in Texas. I'm allowed.
I was born in Texas and all my people from Carolina, sonny. So you better back up off and get a deviled egg. All right. Now, I have so many questions, but I want to start. The one that I had is one of my latter questions. I'm going to go ahead and start with because you were leading in that direction anyway. Mm-hmm. I love sabbatical as taking a break. You know, the framework is like taking a break from your normal life. And a lot of people use it to do other projects. A lot of people use it to really rest down their system. Sometimes people use it for big travel, but almost everyone I've talked to is like, I'm using this to kind of reset my life in some way. Mm-hmm. And what I have found with my sabbatical practice is I'm like, I don't want to leave that behind. Like there's aspects of what I discover in the sabbatical realm mm-hmm. that I want to integrate into my life. And you started saying that, like, I love that. You know, I love how my life was. I love all that I was making. Which aspects of what you discovered on your sabbatical feel like I'm keeping it? Mm-hmm. I'm bringing this with me. Yeah, let's start with that.
That's a great question. I love that as a starting point. Well, I am a artist.
Yes, you are.
I'm an artist, and that is my so much of my sabbatical really was a return. I'm going to get so emotional talking about this because it's just good. Been so it's been so moving. It's been a moving experience inside me to get to do this. What a joy to remember mm-hmm. who I really am. Mm-hmm. Early in my sabbatical, I had this very magical night where I was falling in love with this amazing person, and we met up for the very first time in person in DC, and we had like this one night overlap, and because we both happened to be there at the same time, and it wasn't planned. It was like an unplanned sort of like
it was magical.
It was literal magic, but it was this unplanned of like, oh, we're falling in love with each other. We know we're going. We had this future plan to see each other, yeah. But then we were like, oh my gosh, we're both going to be in DC on this same night. Let's meet up, and. Yeah. One of the things that we did during this very magical night was we went and visited my high school.
I remember.
West Potomac High School, which is in Alexandria, Virginia. And it was nighttime when we arrived. It was like, I don't know, it was like 9 o'clock at night or something. So we just like literally pulled up to the front of the school and got out of the car and just walked around. And I like showed this person like parts of the school and... Mm-hmm. Just from the outside, and
you didn't have the keys.
No. And and you know, because of the way our lives are, you and I, as like, you know, children of a military family and people who just have moved a lot. It has been such a rare experience for me to return to a place that I was as a young person. And actually, during my sabbatical year, it happened twice. And one was that night. So I hadn't been back to my high school in like probably about 20 years.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I could feel so come through so clearly that night was like, oh, this was a place where I existed and just knew I was an artist. And there was no question in my mind or in anyone else's mind about whether I was an artist. And there was no sense at that time. I mean, whatever, hormonal, teenage years, all the things. But I didn't have a sense at that time that I needed to like prove that I was an artist to anyone.
No, not at all.
And I didn't have a sense at that time that like it was like up for debate whether my artistry was like unique or valuable or like worth other people's attention or like any of those things. And then I went off to college and all of that got stripped.
Yeah.
Oh, right? Yeah. You know, and I went to college to like, you know, I ended up, you know, getting very, very, I ended up in a very serious academic track of studying theology, but I also went to college to study art and to study performance art specifically. And the process of doing that in a on a collegiate level stripped me of my identity as an artist.
Wow.
So it was really deep that night to return to this place and to like hear messages from that person. And because that night happened like 6 weeks prior to heading into the studio to record The Animal in You. It was just very meaningful to receive that. And, you know, and then a couple of months later, when I took the kids to Europe, I also got to have,
as one does.
Yeah. this was an important part of my sabbatical. One of my goals of my sabbatical was that I would get to take my children out of the country for the first time. And
it feels so big. Like we grew up in so many places and I'm so glad that you made sure that the kids got to just experience something that's not here.
I mean, it's especially right now. Like it felt so important. Yeah. I was just like, these kids need to know that this is not the fucking center of the world. No. That there is no center of the world. That people just live in a lot of different ways and a lot of different places and have different stories and different cultural reference points. And, you know, it's so important to just get dropped into another setting and just have to figure out how to exist there. And I let them have some say over where we went, which is how we ended up spending half of our time in Paris. but then we spent part of our time in Bavaria in Germany, which is the region that for the audience's edification, it's the region of Germany that Adrian and I lived in when we were children. And so it was another point where I got to revisit places that I had been to as a child and never been back to since. And I'm 40 years old now. I turned 40 during my sabbatical.
You're so 40.
I'm so 40. And so, so all that is to say, I feel that the thing that I got during my sabbatical was I got to recover my core identity as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And also like a sense, I mean, I don't, maybe this might sound overblown to other people, but I have a felt deep sense that being an artist is like what makes humans unique among species. I think that it's our ability to transmute experience and make meaning of it in that particular way is like, I think it's so essentially fundamentally human. And it's been such a beautiful, I was actually just processing this a little bit with my best friend yesterday, the ways that living under late stage racial capitalism, living through end times, living through a genocide, multiple genocides happening at the same time on planet, but like one genocide in particular that we are really, really we're seeing what's happening in a very visceral way. There is a way that because of all of the cultural conditioning we have and the commodification of like every hour of our days, there's a way that that taking time to make art can feel so quote unquote privileged.
Yeah.
And so it's been very helpful for me to resume this as the core identity of my life and to be like, this is not about privilege. This That's is right. about my humanity. And to and actually, in a way, it's been very reinforced by, you know, following some of the people that I follow who are in Gaza, like Bissan and Motaz. Well, Motaz is no longer in Gaza, but one of the things that Motaz has spoken about repeatedly is like, I'm a photographer. I'm an artist.
Yes.
And now, as a photographer, I'm being known for documenting a genocide. And he's talked about how tragic it is in his life. That that is what he's known for. And and it's helped for me reinforce that sense of like, yeah, like a place like he has a right to be an artist. That's part of what's being robbed of him and all of the other people who are living through this genocide right now. Everyone has a right to actually be able to be an artist and make art and be free. Yeah. So anyway, my brain has been making a lot of connections related to that. And so I feel very committed to cultivating a life in which my art is at the center.
I love that.
Yes.
I'm so here for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad you brought up Motaz and brought up like art in a time of genocide generally, right? Because I've been thinking about that so much. I'm like, I also agree with you, you know, that I think we're supposed to be creating, right? Whatever it is we're supposed to be creating, I think that we're actually, a lot of the stuff we busy ourselves with distracts us from what we're supposed to be doing, which is generating and creating. And I think about all the people right now where I'm like, nobody's first choice would be this.
Exactly.
Right? Nobody's first choice would even be organizing people or any of that, I don't think. I think most people's first choice would be creating something, making beauty, making fun, making play. And it's because we've created a social systems and economies that are so dysfunctional that we don't get to do that. Mm-hmm. And I really think it is, just so beautiful and so important when people like yourself, who are so wildly talented, reclaim that space. Because it's like, it's good for you. It would be good whether your art was great or not, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
It would be great, right? Because it just is like, it feels good to be creating. It's good for us because your art is amazing. So it's, you know, for your fans, it's been a really good year. It's been a really good year for us. So I want to spend some more time on the art piece of this.
Yeah.
So you went into the studio and we did a whole beautiful episode. I hope that everyone's already listened to it. It was our listening party for The Animal and You, and it was an incredible thing. I want to ask you now, months later, having the music out and everything, what did you learn about yourself in the studio that has stuck with you?
I learned that I'm incredibly decisive as an artist. And that the more decisive I am, the more spontaneous and improvisatory I get to be also. And I think I would have... I mean,
improvisatory,
improvisational is what I meant.
Yeah, but I like that.
I improvised a new word.
Like, as you may have noticed, even as I speak now.
Exactly. Exactly. What is language? So
make it up. It's all made up.
It's literally all made up.
Literally.
And okay, I'm not going to go down that road, but bring it right back. But when I was heading into the studio the first time, I mean, the whole lead up to going into the studio the first time, I was having to do all of this work around, just what I think what some people would call imposter syndrome. It's not the language that I use for that set of feelings or conditions. That only for me really like approximates it. It's like fundamentally about trusting oneself. And, you know, there's like I said, you know, when I went to college to study art, the thing that got like stripped from me was a sense of myself as an artist and my ability to trust that I am an artist. And so I was having to work through a lot of stories that were coming up inside of me about like, what was good and what wasn't good, or how I could trust that the sounds I was making were good sounds, or did I really know what I needed to know in order to be able to be in a studio with other artists and record things. And I mean, and actually improvisation was a huge part of the improvisation as like both as a concept and also as a musical practice was something that I was really feeling challenged by in the lead up to being in the studio. Being in the studio then completely flipped my whole awareness of what was happening. Because I went into the studio with this like, my vocal coach, Orion Johnstone, who I just have to bless up. Orion is incredible, as an incredible artist, an incredible coach. And they were very supportive in helping me start to blow up some of the stories I had around. I had this whole story that you can only improvise once you've mastered an instrument, and which very much comes from the kind of classical vocal training that I had. And and Orion was helping me to kind of blow that up already. And then I got into the studio and I realized, oh, the way that I make music is through improvisation. That's actually my actual process of making music is improvisation. That's how I everything that I ever have written on the piano, I improvise. Yes. So like I don't identify as someone who quote unquote plays the piano.
Right.
But I improvise at the piano all the time. Yeah. That's how I write music, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like I just had to, you know, the only way that you can figure some of this shit out is by literally finding yourself in the middle of it and realizing what you can do. And this is the same way for me vocally. I do a ton of vocal improvisation and it was a wild ride. And then being in the studio, because in the studio, so much of what you're doing, right, is like you're recording multiple takes of, you know, running at the same parts of an instrumental take, the same parts of a vocal take. And then you're sitting down and arranging all of it together and then making decisions, making choices about what sounds you want to have where. And both the first time I was in the studio and the second time, because we just went back into the studio in April and recorded a second EP, which is going to be coming out this summer. Yay, exciting.
Can we say the name of it yet?
Yes. This is the debut announcement. the name of the next EP is The Way Your Blood Beats.
Girl, you're good at naming albums.
Well, I mean, this is literally James Baldwin, but...
I know, but you chose to name it that.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. The first...
and you're really good at that.
Thank you. Yeah. It was important to me that both of these projects, in the titling of them, that they were like... That they are... I mean, it's important to me in all of my work that I give credit to my predecessor artists and like who I understand myself to be in the artistic lineage of. And so it was very important to me in the titling of both projects to have them be like homages to artists and writers who've inspired me. So The Way Your Blood Beats is an homage to James Baldwin and this beautiful interview that he did that is often republished under the title Go The Way Your Blood Beats. So we were just in the studio again in April. And I think especially the second time I was really able to feel into the dance, the interplay between spontaneity, improvisation, and decisiveness. And it's similar to how I experience Aikido, right? Like that in when you're in a martial arts training, you know, one of the things that I have heard my teacher say that is like wisdom he's passing on from other teachers is this notion that discipline makes way for freedom. And that the more disciplined you are, and which in a musical process, you could think of that as being decisive and like really creating clear containers for the music. The more disciplined or decisive you are, the more room it makes for actual freedom and spontaneity to then happen inside of those containers. And so that was one of the things I really learned about myself, that like, not just as a composer, vocalist, instrumentalist, but also as like an arranger of music.
Yeah.
That I am very decisive. I have very strong opinions about things. I don't feel lost in the sauce, you know? Yeah. Like I feel really clear about like, I feel a clear sense of like, oh, I'm responsible for this song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Hello, beloveds. I'm back. Did you miss me? I missed you. Okay, so as you know, our show does not run on ads, and that's intentional. We are brought to you entirely by you, by your support. If you support us on Patreon already, thank you so much. If not, now is a great time to join. We've got t-shirts, we've got tote bags, we've got mugs, we have original art by Sister Adrian. And also, Adrian and I do these sporadic Ask Us Anything episodes, which are exclusively available to our patrons, where we're answering questions from patrons. So think about it and then just act on it. Become a patron today. In order to do that, in order to support the sustainability of our podcast, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/endoftheworldshow. Thank you. Okay, let's get back into it.
Now that the music is out, you know, one of the things that I have found is that like different accomplishments really yield different feelings in me, right? So there's some things that I'm like, oh, yeah, technically that's done, but like, you know, I don't know. There's just certain things I feel. I'm like, it's done. I did it. I got it done.
Now it's over.
Yay.
Let it go.
There's other stuff where, you know, like when I turned in emergent strategy where I was like, I have completed a holy task.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I was given this to do and I have done it well.
Yes.
Or, right. And then when it was out in the world, it felt very different as an accomplishment because I was like, oh, other people feel something holy in it. Amazing. Because I was like, I didn't even know whether you would or not. I just knew that I was supposed to do it.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you now, having the animal in you out in the world, having people listening to it, reflecting, playing on the radio, people booking you, like, how does that accomplishment feel different? Or if it does, I'm assuming it does, but how does that accomplishment feel in relationship to other things that you have accomplished in your life?
Okay, true story. When I guess right now I'm going to be speaking more to the experience of like, I'll come back to the accomplishment of putting it out into the world, because that feels different to me than the accomplishment of like completing the studio recording process, which in some ways felt like the accomplishment.
That, yes.
You know?
Right?
Like the moment of turning in the book.
Exactly.
Right? For me, that was...
It's the private moment where
the private moment of like, oh my God, I did it. I made an album.
I did it.
And, and here's a funny thing about me, which anyone who's listened to our show for any length of time probably knows. I'm very reactive to people using the metaphor of birth for creative projects.
Oh, I know.
Historically, yes. I have been very... Like,
please,
when people say like, I birthed a book baby, you know, or whatever, I'm just like, no, you didn't. That's not a baby. That's not the same. There's nothing about that that's similar. And yet, once I got through the experience of recording the animal in you, I remember like leaving the studio and being like, yep. Birth is actually the only metaphor that like comes close to like circumscribing what this feels like.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, I would say like, you know, my actual children are not accomplishments. I just want to be clear.
But, gold star. Me.
But, right. I mean, they are amazing, but they're not my accomplishments or my children. But the experience of like laboring and birthing a child
yeah,
is like, and like successfully birthing a child, like surviving that experience, having a healthy, like living child on the other side of it, especially if you've gone through the not yes, living child version of it. Like you really, yeah, you really feel what a miracle it is every time a child is born alive.
Yes.
And like, there is something for me about not just, it's not even like the gestation and like, oh, now I have a baby and oh, look, they're growing up. It's more like the actual experience of like, I let this come through my body.
That's what it is.
That's what it is. Like that, that's the accomplishment, is like, I was able to release and let the mystery take over because it wasn't my brain, yes, that was in charge of that. And yeah, I let my body actually do this thing that it's capable of, that my brain doesn't believe it's capable of, but my body, that's does right, know it's capable of. Like, I was able to like get out of the way and allow it to happen and look at this miracle. Yeah. And so for me, that's the equivalency of the album, is the like, look at how I let my brain get out of the way and let my body, my instrument, make this beautiful thing. Yes. And look how I was able to pull in and magnetize to me these brilliant artists who helped me birth, yeah, this beautiful thing through my body, that's right, you know? And that's right. That to me is the feeling of like, that's what makes it different than like, cause yeah, I mean, similar to what you've described, like my whole career as like a political thinker, as a movement, yeah, strategist, as a facilitator, as an organizer, like I have devoted my entire adult life to the left.
Yeah.
I mean, paid and unpaid, as you know, right? And, right, and in fact, yes, and in fact, most of the work that I have done that I feel most proud of and most accomplished unpaid around will ever know about that shit. You know, yeah, what I mean?
It's no, not, that's
it's
deeply
both,
true.
It's both unpaid and also completely behind the scenes, right? It's like,
I honestly am just like, you haven't really done movement work if you don't have a lot of it that's behind the scenes.
Exactly.
And no one will ever
exactly
know about.
Exactly. Like that's, yeah, that's the actual real left, is the shit that, mm-hmm, no one even knows is happening in my mind. But, but irregardless, like I've my whole adult life, I mean, actually I started as a student organizer. So from my adolescence all the way up to
literally,
now,
yes,
I have devoted my life to the left. And I have always felt in my purpose in that work. Like I, yeah, and I have accomplished so many things, both in public and in private, that I feel very, very proud of. And I never felt this inside of my political, yeah, work. Like I've never felt this level of like full spiritual alignment, mm-hmm, with like what God wants me to be doing. You know what I mean? Like that's what this feels like.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean,
yes, sister.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, and I think we could have a whole talk sometime about spirit and movement and how I think such a big aspect of what's missing in movement is an embrace of the spiritual and an embrace of the larger than sense, the larger than science, the larger than tangible, like that aspect. It feels like right now it's kind of a sidebar that happens when we show up to a big march, or it's a sidebar of what happens in a moment of victory. But I'm like, I think it's actually, you know, I'm like, at what point do we contend and say we've got worldview level of adjustments that we're trying to make that are at the level of the spirit? So let's put a pin in that, because we have all of next season. And we'll talk before we get off this call, we can tell people what we're looking at for next season.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to hear that from you, especially, because it does feel like you're not the only person. Like, I feel like I've had a lot of friends who've been like in movement and then done something else. It was like, oh, that's like the divine plug of me.
Right.
And then trying to figure out, and it's so funny, because the next question I have is like about balancing the self and the world, right? It's like, how do we balance, once you awaken the self, how do you balance it with what the world needs, right? Mm. And for you this year, you've talked about some of your teachers, and I want to name them back to you as I heard them. Injury was actually one of your big teachers this year.
Huge.
Love has been one of your big teachers this year. Having space has been one of your big teachers, right? Being like, oh, with this room, what am I going to do? How am I going to spend it? Some of it's for grief. Some of it's for art. Some of it's for family, right? But there's just something about the relationship you have to how you use the spaciousness of your life when it's not over full. Mm-hmm. And then art itself, being an artist, you know, that has taught you. They feel like such important teachers. Like, I'm really grateful. You know, I've been watching you go through the lessons. But I think this last question I have is like, having had all that teaching for yourself, how do you now balance that self you have with the world as it is right now?
Oh,
and, you know, like, how does it impact how you mother? How does it impact how you return to work? How does it impact how you talk to friends? You know, like how is it changing how you show up for crisis? Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I think my first response is there is no separation between me and the world. That's one of the things that I feel like I really was able to tune into through my artistic practice, right? And through my, like, the more that I committed to myself, the more I understood that I'm not separate from anyone. I'm not separate from anything. And I'm not like, that was the other, I mean, it's hard to even put words to right now, but it was like, the more that I committed to my artistic practice, the more that I committed to myself and my health and my well-being, the more I could see that I wasn't taking a break from my work. And that I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't like gonna go off and do something and then go back. It was more like, no, I'm just off in the forest. Like I've been saying, we all need to go do. I'm off in the forest and I'm just gonna still be out here.
Keep going,
no matter what ways the world sees me, I know that I'm in the forest.
That's right.
Right? And the balance then is to be really aware that that's where I am. Like no matter who I'm interacting with and no matter how they're interacting with me, I'm in the forest. You know, like one of the pieces of wisdom that kind of downloaded to me in February while I was on a trip was this notion that, you know, as human beings, historically, like when a majority of humans living on Earth were in non-militarized, indigenous, intact societies, we had very strong orientation practices. And I mean geographic, physical, spatial orientation practices. Yeah. And one of the things that colonization takes from us, and one of the things that modernization has really taken from us, is orientation and the ability to orient oneself spatially. And it kind of downloaded to me as like, oh, globalization of disorientation. That's what we're in.
Ooh, I like that.
Like we don't know how to,
I like it.
We don't know how to find our way places.
Literally,
physically, we don't know how to find our way, but the capacity is in us, and actually it's part of our design as creatures to be able to orient and find our way. And so, you know, so for me, when I think about how do I balance like all that I'm bringing now, part of it I think is about just really taking a lot of responsibility for my orientation, you know, and not getting, it's like so easy. I mean, again, in crisis of individualism, it's so easy to get so frustrated when people don't understand us and understand who we are, you know? And like, and I've certainly had moments like that, even in the last couple of months, of being like, you don't fucking understand who I am, and you don't get me, and you don't get this, and you don't know this, and you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I could go there just as quickly as anyone else. But the wisdom that I hold now is that my responsibility is to orient myself. And I actually have the capacity to orient myself. And if I can orient myself appropriately to my conditions, yes, then it doesn't actually matter as much whether anyone else understands what I'm doing.
I love this because it's actually what I've witnessed in you is that it actually shows up as a lot of care, right? Because the better you're oriented, the more you're able to be very honest about your capacity, about your mood, about your needs, about what you have to bring to the table. Like, you're not like, oh, I'm just living my life in an overblown state.
Right.
You're like, no, I'm living within a very precise capacity. And I know when it's challenged, and I can tell you, I don't have the capacity right now. Mm-hmm. I'm oriented, right? I literally, this also feels like, I know that you're speaking about all the different things, but that feels like one of the biggest lessons of the injury, right? Was like, now I'm in this place. How do I get from this place to that place? In the most literal sense, I need to get myself and this teacup and these things and my charger and my phone.
Exactly.
And I'm a single mom and the kids are gone and I've got to get myself from this place to that place.
Yo, right? And it's humbling. I mean, you remember I had the night that I got home from my when I was injured in Philadelphia and then I traveled home 2 days after I was injured, and a dear friend of mine picked me up from the airport and got me settled in the house. But then she had to go home to her family. And then, and so then I'm alone in my house and I have to get myself up the stairs with a freshly injured ankle that I cannot. I mean, I remember having as I'm like scooching myself up the stairs, getting myself from point A to point B. I remember having this thought of like, oh, this is not safe. Yes. It's not safe for me to be alone. Good lesson. Now I'm oriented. Right.
This is what I mean, right? So I think this is, it's like calming my anxiety and my stress and everything out. It's like calming so much of my system down. Mm-hmm. I think I haven't named it what you're naming it. And you're just giving me like a nice light bulb on the situation.
Bing.
I've been thinking of it as being with what is.
Right?
But I'm like, oh, I'm such a magical thinker. And like, I've always been like the most magical thinking person.
So
I'm like,
what is could be very imaginary.
For me, being with what is like, I don't even see what is. I'm like, what are you talking about? We're all living in this like future oriented world that I already determined. We just have to get there. But like, we don't have, you know, like when I'm dealing with people, like especially when people in movement or something, and I see something that feels like overtly, you know, dominating or regressive or ignorant or whatever, I'm just sort of like, I'm so confused, right? And fragility confuses me, right? Fragility has traditionally confused me a lot. I never see it coming. I'm always like, we all said that we wanted to do this, and so we're doing it. Let's go. And you said you could handle that, so that's your job. And I'm going to just do mine. I'm not going to check on you ever again. Like, just do it. And what, like, that's just me, right? I'm just like, I don't know. I just, you said you could handle the ball, so I threw it to you.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
And then being like, oh no, there's fragility in all these systems, including inside of the system of me. And so how do I hold on to magic? Where's the right place for magic in my life? But then orient to what is and be like, in this moment, I have no idea if that person can catch the ball or not. They've said they can catch the ball. Let's experiment. I'll throw them a ball.
And keep an eye on it as it's going.
I'm going to watch the ball until it lands with them. I'm going to see how they catch it, if they look surprised, skilled, blah, 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 da, 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 whatever.
Right.
And then I'll see what happens next, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
if they repeatedly fumble the ball.
Yeah. And it's also like, I'm not going to throw the breakable Fabergé ball. I'm going to throw the like soft Nerf ball, right? And then we'll build up from there, right? And I've been applying that. I've been really slowing down and applying that all throughout my life. Mm. Just like, what if every single system is fragile and every single person is fragile? How can I be with that being what is? And then how do we move from fragility to fortitude?
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Collectively, if all the cells have fragility in them, collectively, how do we achieve fortitude?
Right.
Right? And so, yeah. But what you said, it's like, I'm not separate from the world. I'm figuring this out in myself.
Yes.
As we figure this out in the world.
Yes.
So I want to ask you if there's anything else about your sabbatical that you wanted to share with the audience that I didn't ask about.
Yes, I definitely am so, and I'm like, so excited that you brought in the magic piece because it's such a good segue into what we're going to talk about next. I think.
Oh yeah.
Let's see. I think there's a funny thing about taking a sabbatical because it's like, it's sort of like an extended version of the thing that you discover when you go on vacation or just like take a week off of work, which is like, you have a very full life independent of your job.
Absolutely.
And I think this is probably the case for most people that it's like your time very quickly is filled with your actual life.
Yes.
And then you're sort of looking at your actual life and you're like, how do I also have a job in relationship to this life? And that's been the case for me my whole adulthood. Anytime I take a break from work, I'm sort of like, time is weird. Time is really weird. I don't know how we fit all the things into our days that we somehow do. And I think that that's the, I mean, like, it's going to sound a little wooey, I guess, but.
Go there.
But I feel, you know, we have all these different ways that we talk about it. Like, time is a construct and time is a this, that, and, you know, whatever. But it's like, yeah, what I'll say is time just isn't what we think it is.
Period.
Time just isn't what we think it is. It's not linear. It's also not cyclical. It's not any shape that we can imagine. Like, it's the most clear I feel about time is that it is a version of space. That it's like, it is, time is a spatial experience. That I feel clear about. But it's not like, it doesn't take a shape that we understand.
That's right.
It doesn't take a shape that we understand. And it's not, and it's much more magical than we understand it to be.
I agree.
And so I just feel like that's my little like my little flower that I'm floating off into the pond of like what everyone else can take away from my sabbatical is like, you don't actually know what time is. Float, 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 float.
I love that.
Time is a form of magic. Float, 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 float. Like, time is a form of magic. And like the amount of things that happened to me inside of this year.
Yeah.
Like, I fell in love. I made two albums. I took my children to Europe. I experienced pretty extraordinary family crisis that my family is still trying to find our way through. Yes. I had periods where I slept really well. I had periods where I didn't sleep really well. I had periods where I was training a lot. I had periods where I couldn't move my body. You know, I had a cancer scare. Like, I had so much shit happen to me, right? I just remembered it, you know? Like, I had all kinds of, all kinds of crazy shit happen inside of that time. I had incredible sex. And I also had, like, the sadness of, like, missing my lover, you know? And, like, I, like, all of the things. Like, I've, like, the whole range of the human experience. And, and I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful.
I'm so grateful too. And I just want to affirm you, you know, this isn't the first time you tried to do this and you tried to do it before and life happened. And I feel like this time you were like, I know life happens. So I'm doing this thing. And like, I have enough buoyancy in myself for life to happen and for me to keep coming back to the discipline of loving myself and making my art and loving myself and making my art.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a great job.
Thank you.
And I love you.
I love you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our show. You can make a sustaining donation to our show by visiting our page at patreon.com/endoftheworldshow and start giving at any level. Another incredibly helpful thing you can do to help our show sustain itself is to write us a review on Apple Podcasts if you're an iPhone person. Thank you. How to Survive the End of the World is produced and edited by the incomparable Zach Rosen, our brother from another mother. Music for today's show comes from Tunde Olaniran, Mother Cyborg, The Bangsons, and Autumn.